Sailing he is, or rather they are, Captain Paul Watson and the men and women of the Sea Shepherd Movement, who in their various vessels plough through the planet's waters in their attempts to defend our ocean wildlife. The arrival in March 2017 of the Ocean Warrior in Western Australia marked the end of this year's anti-whaling campaign against Japanese whale poachers. A mission Sea Shepherd call Operation Nemesis. Welcome to Safe and Sound, New Zealand's only animal rights radio show, broadcasting from access stations right across the country. My name's Sandra Kyle, and I'd like to extend a special warm welcome to Fresh FM in Nelson, who've just come on board, if you pardon that nautical pun. Last week we heard the first part of Paul Judge's interview with Captain Watson, and today we're delighted to bring you part two. We'll pick up the interview at the point where Paul asked why it was that the Japanese were stockpiling whale meat.
They don't make any money off of this at all. It's been heavily subsidized every year by the Japanese government. It's really about, they believe if they give in on whales, they have to give in on bluefin tuna and the other species that they're overly exploiting. The policy of the Japanese Ministry of Fisheries is to not compromise on anything. And it doesn't matter whether it's fisheries or whales or whatever. There are other reasons. One of the things is that the directors of the Institute for Cetacean Research are all political, former politicians who are given this cushy job, a couple $100,000 a year to hold this job. And if they shut down whaling, of course, they're out of jobs and they're all friends of the Prime Minister and the other members of the government. Another factor is that the union that provides the crew for the ships is a union controlled by the Yakuza, and of course they're putting considerable pressure on the Japanese government also. Also, Japan would like to keep an economic foot in the door in Antarctica, because when the Antarctic Treaty expires, all these nations are going to be battling for the resources of Antarctica, and Japan wants to be able to say, you know, we have an economic investment already, we've been operating down here, and therefore we should have, you know, part of the pie, because currently, right now, they're not members of the treaty, the Antarctic Treaty. They want to be part of that. So there are many factors for why this is happening, and also the Japanese tend to be, traditionally, historically, an extremely stubborn, very self-centered nation.
It's incredible, isn't it? Because they are basically really define world opinion on this, aren't they?
Yeah, they don't really care. They don't care because they know that they have a lot of governments in their back pocket, like Australia, New Zealand, which are basically just colonies of Japan.
Economic colonies, and China, you say, as well.
And China also.
If you could just go back a little bit, the failure of Australia to respond to the Japanese in the whale sanctuary that had been set up. And you got recently, just in January, photographs of a whale that had been killed in that sanctuary. What are your thoughts about Australia's response to that?
Well, Australia really doesn't have any response. This government in Australia now made a lot of promises about what they're going to do, but just like the previous government before them, they didn't carry out on those promises. they're mainly more interested in appeasing Japan than they are their own people. You know, for instance, every time we came back into Australia, the Australian Federal Police would be down and interrogating us, collecting evidence on the request of the Japanese government. But when we actually reported crimes by Japan against us, the answer from the Australian Federal Police was always, it's out of our jurisdiction. So we never understood how come what happened in the Southern Ocean is in their jurisdiction when the Japanese want something, but is not in their jurisdiction when we want something.
We just had a stranding. You might have heard about it. 400 pilot whales stranded on the Farewell Spit, which is at the tip of the South Island in New Zealand. And we had this professor of zoology from Otago University who said it's possible, but it's highly unlikely that it was caused by seismic testing in the Cook Strait because that stopped a week ago. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, they can easily find out. For instance, the U.S. government wouldn't allow any necropsies on any of the whales that were stranded in the U.S., which we suspect was from sonar testing. Then some of them landed in the Canary Islands, and we were able to get in there and do the necropsies and found out they all had burst eardrums. I think that's what they should do for these whales, if it's not too late, in New Zealand, is to do an autopsy where the eardrums burst. What can they find? Because I believe that the whales that were stranded in New Zealand were from seismic testing. And, of course, the oil companies and the military are the people behind all of these sonar and seismic tests. And, you know, they've got a considerable amount of power, money, and influence. But I think that all marine mammals are in danger of so many things, from plastic pollution to acidification to diminishment of fish to radiation, you name it. I mean, the ocean is dying. That's the plain, hard fact. It's dying. It's diminishing before our eyes. Since 1950, there's been a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton populations around the globe. Phytoplankton provides up to 70% of the oxygen that we breathe. Now, phytoplankton are being diminished because they require certain nutrients to survive, nitrogen and iron. And those nutrients are primarily provided by whales. Whales, for example, defecates about 3 tons of feces on the surface, heavily rich in nitrogen and iron. The whales are, in fact, the farmers of the ocean. And everything in the ocean is intimately linked with everything else. So when you diminish one species, you diminish another. You destroy one species, it leads to the destruction of another. The oceans are dying. And if the ocean dies, we die. And this should be the number one concern of every human being on this planet, because if that ocean, which is our life support system, breaks down, we are in danger of not surviving as a species.
So you talked about acidification. What are the effects that you've noticed?
Bleaching of coral reefs is one of them. The inability for fish to survive. We're seeing massive dead fish coming up on the coast in Chile, in Nova Scotia, in France, all over the place. These things are becoming a very common occurrence. The ocean is dying before our eyes, and people are just willfully denying it, just like many people willfully deny climate change, vested economic interest in denying reality.
Yeah, it's a dismal picture, isn't it? What's kind of interesting is that people like yourself are just so committed to fighting the battle, doing stuff directly to intervene and save individual animals, but you're raising awareness. So, you know, you must have some degree of hope that things can be turned around.
Well, I do, but the enemy is ourselves. We're in a war to save this planet and ourselves from ourselves, really. And, you know, I'm optimistic for many reasons. One, because I think that things can change. The impossible can become possible. In 1972, for example, the very idea that Nelson Mandela would be president of South Africa one day was unthinkable, certainly impossible, and yet it happened. So I have a lot of faith that the impossible can be made possible. And, you know, there's been 5 major extinction events in the history of this planet. We're now in the midst of the 6th of them, called the Anthropocene, because we're responsible for it. And history has shown us that it takes about 18 to 20 million years for the planet to recover from a major extinction event. So at the end, it'll be a nice planet 18 to 20 years, 20 million years from now.
And that's if the ionizing radiation doesn't spew out of the 440 nuclear power stations that melt down and do a Fukushima on us.
Yeah, but even then, time will heal. It won't heal it for us, though, but it will heal it for the planet. This isn't about saving the planet. The planet can do very well. It's about saving ourselves from ourselves.
Just getting back to plastic pollution, that's a concern that I think a lot of people are starting to wake up to. You know, there's campaigns to stop the microbeads and so on, plastic, prohibiting plastic bags in supermarkets, and all these things are sort of starting to happen. But what are your thoughts on actually cleaning up the oceans of the plastic? Can that be done?
Well, when I started working in the 80s trying to tell people, well, plastics, nobody was interested. They all thought we were crazy. Now people are becoming more aware of it. Well, we're involved with many organizations, and we're actually working with Adidas, for example, to recycle ocean plastic into different things. But, of course, that's just a small measure. How do we get rid of plastic in the ocean? It's almost physically impossible to actually recover it. But what we are seeing is promising insights into the fact that bacteria are evolving that will eat it. And, of course, we thought that would take hundreds of thousands of years, but it's actually happening right now. So that gives me some optimism. What we are doing, though, is we have teams all over the world that are collecting plastic from the beaches. That's the easiest place to collect them, and filling up containers and shipping them to places where they can be recycled into things which aren't actually disposed of so easily. For example, the 70 tons of gill net that we confiscated from the Southern Ocean set by those poachers, turned that over to Adidas, and they're making running shoes out of it. Running shoes are not something you actually throw away, well, at least not into the ocean. You know, there are many things that are trying. There's Parley for the Oceans is a group. There's many organizations that are working to address that plastic issue. But it is a serious issue because plastic does break down into small particles which look just like plankton, and fish eat it, birds eat it, and it causes, it's very lethal.
Yeah, it's a serious problem, and it's great that you guys are doing such wonderful work there, because that's not something that people would generally know about Sea Shepherd. It's great to hear that. Look, I'm really interested. I read some information about you, and I was doing some research that you've got this biocentric philosophy. Really interested to hear what your ideas are about that.
So, biocentric point of view is something that everybody once understood, and now it's restricted to indigenous cultures, and that is the understanding that we're part of everything else. We're part of nature. The anthropocentric view, which is the dominant view right now, is that we're the center of everything. We're the lords of the entire domain. Everything was created just for us. It's a complete fantasy, but it's one that people sincerely believe in. The biocentric point of view says, no, we're no better than all the other plants and animals on the planet. You know, I've been criticized for saying that bees and trees and worms are more important than people. And people said, how can you say something so horrible? And I said, well, I'm saying it because it's true. Bees and trees and worms can survive very well without us, but we can't survive without them. That makes them ecologically more important than we are. And there's many species that are far more important than we are. And we have to understand that we're part of all that. We cannot set ourselves aside and say, we're special. The laws of ecology don't apply to us. We'll do whatever we want. I mean, we can do it, but we're not going to survive very long if we continue on that road.
What are your thoughts on the evolutionary development of the human brain? How did we get to this stage?
Well, it evolved, of course, for many reasons, but still quite primitive when you think about it. I mean, the brain itself is not really the key. If you take a human being or even a Neanderthal from 30, 35,000 years ago, you'll find that, you know, the brain is pretty much the same. That's not what made us into what we are now. What it is a collective memory. You know, each and every one of us is pretty primitive. We couldn't, like, live on an island and make a gun or whatever like that. Mm. But all of our knowledge is accumulative. Mm. In fact, I've always joked that the most important thing that I ever learned when I went to college was in archaeology, when I learned how to make stone tools. Now, that might come in handy someday.
You are one of the few people that's willing to talk about population control. I think that, you know, it's almost a no-no kind of subject area for people to go to. Tell us about your thoughts on that, the problems with human overpopulation, population overshoot, if you like.
Yeah, the problem is, as soon as you start talking about it, you immediately get accused of being a misanthrope or a racist or whatever. Mm. But it's something that has to be addressed. I mean, there's simply not enough room for ever-expanding human populations and the consumption that goes along with that. You know, what we need to do is we really need to find a effective way of doing that, a voluntary sort of system to do it in. But right now, our population is being controlled to some extent by wars and disease and poverty and all of these things, which are pretty horrible. There's got to be a better way of dealing with it. Then, of course, rather intelligent people will say, well, I'm not going to have any children because, well, you know, I don't want to contribute to the population problem. The problem is if you're smart enough to know that, then you're the ones who should be having children.
Exactly.
99% of everybody else is having children, and they don't give a damn. I think that being a parent is an awesome responsibility and requires an extreme discipline. And so it's not a question of how many children you have, it's how you raise them. The problem is that most children are being brought into a planet by parents who have no idea, you know, what they're doing or any real clear vision for the future. My plan on this is very, very controversial, and people don't like it. It's a simple one, and that is that people should not be allowed to have children until they take a course in how to be a proper parent, how to give the child everything that child needs. And then it's like getting a prescription. Okay, you're pregnant. Otherwise, the problem is just anybody can have a child. A child abuser can have a child. Alcoholics, drug addicts, anybody. I mean, we seem to think that this is our right, that we can just overpopulate the planet, consume all of the resources.
I mean, there's nothing short of madness to think that we can just keep doing this, and like you say, within this irresponsible fashion. It's problematic, though, isn't it? Because how do you police it? I mean, it takes education. You have to sort of do things absolutely humanely, and it's such a
fraud. Well, the biggest hurdle, of course, is trying to get around the incredible levels of human stupidity on this planet. I was doing a talk show on a right-wing radio station in the United States one time, and I said to them, you know, I'm far more conservative than you people are. You guys think you're conservative. You don't even know what it means. You can't be a more conservative person than a conservationist. That's what it is. And I said, okay, test me on my conservative value. And they said, well, what's your position on gay people and women in the military? And I said, well, I'm absolutely opposed to it. I don't think gay people or women should be in the military for a very good reason, because I don't think men should be in the military. And why would we aspire to do that? They said, well, what's your position on welfare? I said, I'm totally opposed to welfare, especially all those corporate welfare bums who are getting money from the government every time so they can be bailed out all the time. And then they said, what's your position on abortion? I said, I'm absolutely opposed to abortion, all those postnatal abortions that are allowed to come into the world because everybody's so concerned about the fetus, but as soon as the baby's born, they couldn't give a damn about it, you know? So it's like the hypocrisy you have to deal with, and I think that my conservative values are probably more addressing that than their so-called pseudo-conservative values.
I wonder if you could just tell us what you think is the hope for the oceans. I mean, what do you think is likely to happen? Is there a continuing program for the Sea Shepherd to carry on?
Well, we'll carry on doing what we're doing, but if we're going to save the oceans, governments have to probably bring into effect a global moratorium on all commercial fishing for at least 50 years to allow the ocean to repair itself, or else there won't be any fishing industry by 2048 because there won't be any fish. So I think this is really robbing all future generations of these incredible ecological treasures because of greed. And, you know, back in ancient Polynesian times, you know, the shaman would say that, well, this bay, say in Tahiti, is off limits. Anybody caught fishing here, this bay is taboo. If anybody's caught fishing there, it's a death penalty. And people say, well, that's a little barbaric and extreme. And I'm going, no, because there's a reason for that. The Polynesians understood that if the fish died, they died. Therefore, it was incredibly important that they practice conservation. So, yes, it's a harsh penalty, but rather them do that than watch the entire Polynesian people be wiped out because they've removed all the resources they were dependent upon. The problem is today is we have no taboo areas in the world's oceans. Everything is there. The fish can't hide anywhere. The fish aren't given a break. And every time you turn around, you know, a fishery is in trouble, going commercially extinct. For example, orange roughy is a fish around your area.
Yeah.
It was in all of the supermarkets in the 90s. It was everywhere, and now you don't see it anywhere because this is a fish that takes 55 years to become sexually mature. It lives to be about 100 years old, and yet cannot keep up with our demands. One species after another that is disappearing this way. We just go on to another one, and we go on to another one. I'm always joking that at some time we're going to be eating jellyfish because there won't be anything left.
It's interesting that you talk about this notion of indigenous cultures have this idea of protecting what's valuable and to their survival. Maori culture, you probably know, has this concept of rahui. One of the things is there's been this battle over the Kermadec Islands as a sea sanctuary. I'm wondering if you probably know about that. I'm sure you do. And the New Zealand Maori Party have been coming out and saying that that's an attack on their customary fishing rights and so on. It's almost like they can't see the wood for the trees. They're opposed to this setting up of a ocean sanctuary because of their customary rights to fish it. And yet, historically, they never, ever went there and fished it anyway.
But But you have to keep in mind that indigenous cultures today are not as biocentrically oriented as they were in the past. And the more that they're assimilated into modern so-called European whatever society, no different than anybody else. I have met a lot of Maori people who are really do understand those indigenous values and see the world from a biocentric point of view, just as I've met a lot of Aboriginal people do the same.
I'd really like to get your thoughts on animal sentience. Obviously, that's a given that you are a really big believer in the value of these creatures, right down to the individual animals that you're saving from being killed. What are your thoughts on the sentience and intelligence of marine mammals?
Well, I think I happen to believe they're more intelligent than we are, but it's how we measure intelligence. It's by our values, which are primarily eye-to-hand coordination. You know, the communication abilities of whales and dolphins are far, far more superior than anything that we're capable of. But every species is intelligent relative to its needs. For example, you know, I was once arguing with a whaler from Norway, and he said, "Well, Watson, you say that whales are more intelligent than people. This is really a stupid, stupid thing to say." And I said, "Yes, but you have to look at their intelligence within their society. Everything is intelligent." And then he said, "Oh, so you're saying that cockroaches are intelligent too?" I said, "In their own way, they are." And he just couldn't understand that concept at all. To human beings, being intelligent means believing in God or, you know, having a good investment portfolio or whatever. But if the intelligence is measured by the ability to live in harmony with the natural world, that, to me, puts most species in a far more intelligent category than we are.
Yes, and I think scientifically they've proven that orcas, for example, have a much more developed, you know, the emotional aspect of the brain, don't they? Much more developed. It's much bigger than ours.
Well, the human brain's an average 1,700 cubic centimeters. The average weight of a size of an orca brain is 6,000 cubic centimeters. The sperm whale is 9,000 cubic centimeters. All mammals have three lobe brains except for cetaceans, which have four lobe brains, and that fourth lobe is primarily involved with associative behavior. I happen to think, for that reason, they are far more intelligent than we are. We don't understand their language. It doesn't mean they don't have a language. What we have discovered is orcas in Iceland have a different language than orcas, say, in British Columbia. You know, that's something amazing in itself. We also discovered that dolphins actually address each other by a name. They have a name for each other.
It's incredible.
These are just things that we're learning. I think that someday, I really believe that if we don't wipe them out, that we will be able to communicate with them, because cetacean brains almost communicate in the same way our computers do, by sending a large amount of information in small sound bites.
One of the things I've always hated, is right from a child, I hated, you know, my father was a big fisherman and I never used to go out in the boat with him because I just didn't like it, you know, it didn't feel right for me. Kill an animal, you pull it out of the water and you kill it. There's this thing about fish, isn't there? There's much more disregard for marine creatures, even more than farm animals on the land. We just think that they don't feel, they don't have sophisticated lives, which we are interrupting. They're just there as product for us to take.
That's true, and you know, we would never allow on land what we do to animals on land as we do to animals in the ocean. The bluefin tuna, incredible species. It's faster, the fastest fish in the ocean. It's a warm-blooded fish. We just don't go out and mass slaughter the cheetah just so that for you know, to consume them. That's just not acceptable.
Yeah.
But everything in the ocean is up for slaughter. We can kill everything. And we don't have any compunction about it right now. Like, for instance, in Taiji, Japan, driving entire schools of or pods of dolphins into the cove and then slaughtering them all except for the choice specimens that they want to sell to the marine aquariums. This is something the zoos used to do in the 1920s, but, you know, kill all the adult gorillas so they can get the babies or whatever. And so that's totally unacceptable today with land animals, but it still carries on with marine animals.
Are you having any luck with stopping that happening in Japan with the dolphins?
Well, no, because we're handicapped by the fact that we're in Japan and subject to Japanese laws. We have reduced the quota slightly, but we certainly have embarrassed Japan, but it also cost them a lot. It cost about $1.5 million just to police us while we're there. So we're trying to put economic pressure, media pressure on it, really. But we're really handicapped by the fact that it is in Japan. But we keep trying to come up with new ideas to deal with that. That's why we call that operation Infinite Patience.
I just find it hypocrisy that we can condemn that, and yet we'll celebrate going out and angling marlin, you know, the sport of catching marlin and keeping it on a line, you know, deep sea fishing. Talk about torturing an animal. If you did that to a dog, you'd end up in jail, wouldn't you? But these people treat it like a sport.
If we like it, it's okay. If we don't like it, we condemn it.
It's been terrific talking to you. Maybe we could finish off by letting listeners know how they can help, how they could get involved and maybe contribute in some way.
Well, we have Sea Shepherd New Zealand, which can easily be found online or through Facebook. And so we're trying to build up a Sea Shepherd in New Zealand. But we have a lot of support in New Zealand, and hopefully we'll have a lot more.
Thanks for being on the show, and we'll look forward to talking to you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Paul Judge and to Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd. It's really hard to overstate the case that if the ocean dies, we die. And the ocean certainly does need a strong defence. It seems to me that business as usual is no longer an option. Well, if you'd like to know more about the work of Sea Shepherd, or if you're interested to donate, to help their work, or to volunteer, please go to seashepherd.co.nz, where you can find out more. At the beginning of part one of this interview, we played a very moving track by the wonderful Pete Seeger, The Song of the World's Last Whale. And we'll go out now on another recording of this song. This time it's by Pete Baldwin. And right at the beginning of the track and through it, you can hear the haunting sound of an actual whale's song. Who knows, maybe it is echoing Rod Stewart's words. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Through the dark night, far away, I am dying, forever crying, to be with you, who can say? Thanks, everyone. Go well. See you next week.
I love the song of the world's last whale, as I rocked in the moonlight, as the reef is sailed. It'll happen to you, also without fail. It happens to me, sang the world's last whale. It was down in Bermuda early last spring, near an underwater mountain where the humpbacks sing. I lowered a microphone a quarter mile down, switched on the recorder, let the tape spin round.